Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am net control for the Limark Technical Net. It's been going strong for over 43 years now. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we gather together in front of our radios to exchange information, to learn from each other, teach each other, and hopefully entertain each other. And once again, I thank you all for coming back here on a Sunday night at 8 p.m. To join me in this endeavor. Let me drop for a second, and I will give you the usual links. Okay. If you want to reach me via email, there are two addresses. That would be either for mailbag questions or for topics of discussion. If you'd like to present a timely topic or be part of a discussion of a timely topic, or if you have a tech net puzzle, we're always looking for them. They're few and far between. So if you have any of those, contact me. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Or an alternative is roy@limarktech.net. Also, if you have space or NASA-related stories and you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder, you can email me, but you could also send it directly to him. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. I have a link page of all kinds of interesting articles that I've collected over the last week, and you're free to peruse them at your leisure. The page is up 24/7, so you can see it next tomorrow or next week or next month or probably next year. You get there by typing in roy.ac2gs.com or links.limarktech.net. We have a chat room. It's been very quiet for a couple of months, but you never know. A chat might break out. You can get to that by typing into your browser chat.ac2gs.com or chat.limarktech.net. And, of course, we keep a audio stream of the Technical Net, and we keep it on the rest of the week, so anyone who wants to listen to Glen Oaks is free to do so. You can get to that by typing into your browser technet.ac2gs.com or stream.limarktech.net. And I'd like to remind people regularly that MyKC2NJI has a great archive site. It's amateurradio.tv. He has archived the Limark Technical Nets that go as far back as September of 2006. So please avail yourself of the wisdom of many people who have either moved away from the area or unfortunately become silent keys. Let me drop for a second and I'll tell you what I got planned. Okay. I have a short comment to make at the top of the Technical Net. Shouldn't take too long, and if anyone wants to respond, they're free to. Then we will go into questions, topics, comments, what have you. Preferably, I hope that the first few are amateur radio related, since this is a amateur radio net, but, you know, we will discuss any aspect of science and technology. We'll try to do our best and hopefully give you, at the very least, some reference sources to look it up elsewhere, but we might have something to say on the matter. That should take us to about 10:15, give or take, and then we will have the SpaceNet report by Paul, WS2N. That should take us to approximately 11 o'clock, and I will return to tie a proverbial bow on top of it and wish you well for the following week. So that's the plan. If the repeater and my radio and my computer and all the fun stuff but works the way it's supposed to. Tonight, for some odd reason, every so often my microphone input to my computer forgets itself and needs to be rebooted, and it did that just before the Technical Net, so I'm going Radio Link instead of All Star tonight. So wish me luck. Anyway, that's the plan. So I will drop, and when I come back, I will tell you a little tale. A week ago or 2 weeks ago, I think a couple of times I mentioned it, that the ARRL was up to a little bit of fishy business. They had this thing that they called Bylaw Rule Number 46. That they were planning to push through. that was going to do away with any kind of transparency, apparently. The board of directors didn't have to share much with us. And if the majority of the board of directors voted for something, people who opposed them on the board were not allowed their First Amendment freedom of speech rules. Hopefully some of you took up the cause, as I did, and complained to the people at the ARL, and at the last executive board a week or so ago, they tabled bylaw rule number 46 for the time being. So they decided not to discuss it, not to vote on it, not to pass it, for now. Eternal vigilance is the price for freedom, my friends. So keep an eye out if they plan to reactivate bylaw rule number 46. Any comments before we move on to the next segment? Okay, I will take that as a no thank you. So once again, keep your eye out if you are an ARRL member. Try and do your best, as I shall, to dissuade them from this seemingly non-democratic action. They have delusions of grandeur at Connecticut. They think the ARRL is a business, not a organization of amateur radio operators. Nevertheless, time for our next segment, which is questions, comments, and topics. So if you're out there and you either have a question or a topic or a comment, preferably amateur radio related for the first few, please hit that push to talk. Give me your first name and your call sign.
Curtis. KC2DAW supporting. W2BZ non-ham radio.
KD2VHD, Jim, not ham radio, but electronic communication related.
Okay, is there anyone out there who has a specifically ham radio type of question or comment for tonight? Could you give me your call sign again? There's a little bit of noise in the background.
KE28.
What's your first name, sir? KE2AOB. What's your first name, sir?
Kilo Echo 2 Alpha Lima Papa. I have a ham radio related question.
Okay, very good, Ivan. I got you on the list. Let me just check. Anyone else want to get their name on the list, either for amateur radio related questions or non-amateur radio related questions? Gosh, I hope that wasn't a transmission because it was 99.9% noise. So if it was a transmission of a question or a comment, see if you could raise the gain on your transmitter and the output or wiggle the antenna around or go to higher elevation, whatever might get you into the repeater, because right now you're just noise in the repeater, unfortunately. Okay, well, we will start with what we have, and hopefully, as the night progresses, as it often does, we will get people checking in with other questions or comments and what have you. So our first and only ham radio-related question tonight is from Ivan. What's your question, Ivan?
Good evening, everyone. As I'm studying the science of propagation and electromagnetism and station from the previous, from the last week's net gave me, sent me a wonderful playlist on YouTube. I was just curious, has any major breakthroughs and discoveries in science of electromagnetism and propagation, radio waves, been made recently or for the past decade or two? Basically, the hams of the 50s, is there something that they didn't know about that the hams of today do?
Well, you know, I mean, you started off with 10, 15, 20 years, and then you said the 1950s, which places it more at 70 years. Certainly our understanding of propagation has improved since 1950s. Whether or not there's been any significant new findings in the last 20 years is dubious to me. Propagation kind of grew very, very slowly. We sort of knew about one of the layers, the D layer, early on, but we didn't quite know what it was. We knew it had some characteristics later on, and it was labeled the D. Then they discovered E layers, and then they discovered the so-called F layer that when it gets energized can split into F1 and F2. There is continuing work on surface wave propagation, so that is comes into its own as time goes on and is better explained. That's primarily the two major methods of propagation that we have. Sky wave through refraction of different layers of the ionosphere, dependent upon energizing from sunspots and other sun activities, versus surface wave propagation and some degree of surface wave phenomena that allows for clear channel AM broadcasters to be heard across half of the United States on a good night. So there's been little creeps up about planar waves, surface waves type of things, but I think as far as sky wave propagation and such, except that we don't really know how the sun really works, we have some good ideas, and we have some basic premises, that's still open to interpretation, and if future technology can be more accurately predictive.
Okay, very good. I kind of had a suspicion, so, because the videos that I'm watching are fairly old, 70s or even the archives from the military, 60s or something, I believe. So I guess the fundamentals are pretty relevant today as well. That's pretty much what I wanted to know. Thank you for your info. Thank you.
AC2GSR, you're welcome, Ivan. Like I said, pretty much the ionospheric aspects are pretty much understood. Keep in mind that a lot of times when people describe sky wave propagation, they'll simplify it and tell you that it's just reflecting off of the ionosphere. It's partially reflecting, but it's also refracting, which is a different thing than reflections. It will kind of bend electromagnetic waves back to the surface of the Earth. But, you know, it's always good to keep that in mind. And, you know, I mean, I think that the only thing that needs to be the I's dotted and T's crossed is being able to describe totally surface wave phenomena. Those are local reception usually. But as I mentioned, with AM broadcast, it can get halfway through the country, just kind of hugging the ground as a kind of transmission phenomena between the Earth and the atmosphere right above it as a dielectric. So there's still some things to be read about it. They get a little esoteric, though. There's no kind of fundamental gee whiz popular science type of answers anymore. It's the details that just remain to be finished up on. Any other comments on what I said or what Ivan asked? If you want to add something to your to the answer, feel free. Hit that push to talk.
W-A-2-Z-S-M.
Yes.
Evening, Stu, W-A-2-B-S-M. Roy, that was quite an impressive synopsis you gave. I was extremely impressed. Congratulations, I think. It was a very thorough explanation of to the other station's question. Very impressive.
Well, thank you, Stu. I appreciate that you appreciate it. I try my best. It's one of those great questions that's I found very useful when I found out about it. And unfortunately, there's a little story that I'll relate. I took it at Ham Radio University years ago, and I love Ham Radio University. I did some presentations myself with Andy WA2CDL on test equipment before COVID struck. And I got really annoyed with the guy doing the presentation on propagation because he concept of keep it simple. So rather than get into the concept of refraction, which I like the concept of refraction, that's how prisms work and all kinds of fun stuff, he completely did away with it and just said, well, the electromagnetic waves reflect off of the surface of the ionosphere. And I don't know. I think I took it too personal. I got really annoyed with that simplification.
You sound like colleagues of mine in the courtroom. Very, very in-depth presentation of facts, if you will. I'm not obviously as technically oriented as yourself, but to listen to your presentation here, to your reply, was a learning experience, and I appreciate that. I really did.
Well, once again, I thank you. I'm sort of kind of playing the part of a science popularizer, which can be, I guess, a very lucrative field if you're a professional one. They show up on cable news and YouTube and all kinds of things. And the perpetual problem with trying to explain somewhat technical concepts is that it's very easy to jump down a rabbit hole. If you want to sound as though you're trying to get a PhD out of it, you can gum up the works with real esoteric stuff that serves, in my opinion, no purpose. So the job, as I see it, is to come up hopefully with very good close analogies and not cloud up the issue with somewhat more esoteric stuff that the guys here are probably not that interested in.
Well, I agree with you. By the way, am I correct that you're some type of engineer? Is that correct?
No, but Dick, may rest in peace, kind of made the same mistake. He was way back. I had a terrible antenna system, so I was communicating through emails to people, and so I was kind of a mystery character. And Dick thought that I taught physics. I'm a physician.
Can I ask you what your specialty or subspecialty is, please?
Well, it's kind of appropriate. I am a general internist, so if anything that I do here on the technical net, it's as acting as much a generalist as I can.
Interesting, because I had a seat at NICOM waiting for me, but I had a dramatic change in my family. But as I say to many people, and I won't digress, but my uncle delivered me, another uncle was my pediatrician. My cousin was my internist, and so on and so on. The only non-physician in the family was my dad, who was a lawyer. You can't have it all.
No. My family didn't have that many doctors. Yeah, middle class, Lower East Side guys. I had a cousin who was about 5 years older than me who was a pediatrician, and I have a cousin from the other side of the family who's a anesthesiologist. We probably have more lawyers and accountants. We had a lot of accountants.
I see. Well, I appreciate your sharing that with me. Very interesting. I just want to give a shout out to Jim, just to say hello to him. But thank you so much. It was a pleasure discussing this with you. And I hope I didn't take you off topic. But in medicine, there's always so much new to talk about every day. It's a dynamic field, a dynamic profession rather than static. And we learn every single day in medicine.
Yeah, I would agree, but I think we kind of live in a golden age where there's something new about almost anything. If you sleep late, you miss something. So, I mean, this is the perfect type of time in the world for guys like me who are always curious and looking to hear about new stuff. And I always keep an open mind. I finished the technical nets with that comment from Hepatitis about keeping an open mind. And I hope I do, I demonstrate that as well.
Only Harvey frequency for one more second. Are you familiar with Harrison's on Eternal Medicine?
Yeah, I have it in my bookshelf.
I'm the only attorney who's read 1,750-odd pages of Harrison page by page, because that was my specialty initially, defending doctors and hospitals in professional liability cases. I was reading charts when I was 25 years old, so we were pretty much akin to what I like and what you do for a living. That's great.
Okay, very good. Yeah, Harrison's actually did write the book, I got a pharmaceutical rep to give me a newer version. I had mine from medical school, and it's a very good book. I knew a guy, very nice guy. He kind of memorized it, but I don't think he understood it that much, because every time I would ask him a question, he would basically cite a page. So that was a curious behavior. I never followed up with that gentleman. I hope he's doing well in medicine. But, yeah, it's an excellent book. But I thank you, Stu, all your nice comments. I do appreciate it.
Thank you for sharing. You be well, and we'll just be listening out. Thank you for sharing. WA2ZFM.
Doggy dog, let's move back to the top of our original list. Rich W2BZ, what's your question or comment?
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everybody. The question has to do with me starting to look for a new TV and not knowing whether at this stage of the game I'd be making a mistake not going for QLED over an LED TV and future-proofing it further with 8K over 4K. Do you have a feeling for that, anybody? Roy, go ahead.
Yeah, I got lots and lots and lots of feelings, if you're interested. You really didn't break it down to what it is right now. The two major differences are organic light-emitting diodes versus liquid crystal display. Now, the thing where you're using LEDs a lot, but you're not using organic before it, is not actually the pixel. It's the backlighting for the pixels, which are still liquid crystal displays. So the thing that is called QLED or anything with mini LED or such means that you have a liquid crystal display up front, and if there's a Q in it, you have quantum dot dyes that take the backlit ultraviolet LEDs and they resonate at red, green, and blue, and they give you the primary colors. So the major divide is organic light-emitting diodes and some variety of liquid crystal displays. Liquid crystal displays are much cheaper than organic light-emitting diodes, they don't give you as dark blacks LCDs as organic light-emitting diodes do. But it's getting better. They have what's called these days mini LEDs, which again is just the backlighting. So if you have an almost infinite number of backlit LEDs that can be turned on and off, that means that there's a smaller area of gray instead of the black that people look for. So if money is no object this week, probably organic light emitting diodes is the best technology, all things considered. But for most of us, you're probably best off with some QLED variety where there's a quantum dot and there's a large number of mini LEDs backlighting the LCD.
I guess the only way to really tell is if you look at them together, side by side, a QLED and a regular LED, because, you know, how good is good? When I was a television cameraman back 100 years ago, I remember that the monitors that were professionally set up in the studio by engineers had perfect color, had a perfect picture. I mean, these guys were, you know, had a lot of meters and test equipment to adjust these monitors. And way, way back then, and I'm talking about in the 70s, I never saw any picture duplicated in a home like I saw in the studios, not even close. But now, the picture that I have at home on my TCL 55-inch screen is as good as what I used to see in the studio. So I'm just wondering, how much better does it get? You know, you say the blacks are better, but is it perceivable to the eye? I mean, is it worth that much more money, do you think? WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, I look at them all the time. When I go to a store, you know, either Target has them or Costco by me has it, or of course Best Buy has it. And when you stand and watch and look side by side, you know, by far, in my opinion, the OLEDs are better. You know, I have a very good Vizio from, oh, I guess 12, 13 years ago. My next one, I'm definitely going to try the OLED, but like Roy says, it's a lot more money. But I just think the picture's beautiful. You know, you have to do that, Richard. You got to get to a store somewhere where they have both, and then you look at it, and then, you know, you can make that determination. You know, I don't know if it's the software, you know, they're putting a it's a loop, you know, they go around and around, so maybe they got a better, you know, better loop that they're using for the OLEDs, who knows. They're not, you know, it's not over the air TV and it's not cable TV you're looking at in the store, but whatever I'm looking at, it looks a lot better than the LCDs. But, you know, the LCDs are coming up, you know, the new ones are very good, you know, they're catching up, I think, to the OLEDs, but not quite there yet. Anyway, back to you, Rory.
AC2GS, thank you, Paul. Oh, I mean, there's a lot of factors that go along with the dynamic range. What we're discussing about organic light-emitting diodes, big plus, is that it has a very, very wide dynamic range. The blacks are very black. You don't get as much illumination generally, although that's getting better with every generation of organic light-emitting diodes. I spoke a couple of weeks ago that I thought Consumer Electronics Show was going to really pump up the brightness, and they did it as a selling point. Sony just recently announced. Sony is one of those companies that make a lot of money making studio monitor displays. They announced that they're going to be selling, I think, a $25,000 monitor that is 4,000 nits of brightness, which is a much higher dynamic range than most people are used to watching on their television, so that's interesting. Another thing is reflection. Some people like a slight matte finish because they have a lot of internal reflections going on in their house that can obscure some of the images. Some people like it glossy so that that black stays really deep and dark black. Another big feature that they've been promoting with good reason is upscaling. A lot of times, there's very few streaming services that are going to give you that 8K that you mentioned, Rich, between 4K and 8K. So what the manufacturers are doing is investing in, and of course they're tacking on AI as a term, upscaling so that it will generate kind of false but very aesthetically pleasing detail for those pixels that aren't being provided because most streams are 4K and below. I don't know if 8K is really that necessary. I haven't seen any 8K, so I don't want to discourage people. You know, as Paul mentioned, you know, go into these stores, take a look, and see if you can really tell the difference between 4K and 8K. A big factor is how close you want to be to your screen. If for some strange reason your mother never told you that you'd go blind if you sat in front of the TV screen too close, then you might want the 8K so that you won't see the pixels no matter what you do. For most people, the distance that they usually sit back, I don't know if they could tell the difference between 4K and 8K personally.
You know, I worked in a store way before Best Buy that sold electronics. And the tricks that you could play on people are horrible. You could set up one TV to look perfect and the one next to it to look not so perfect. So I'm always a little leery of stores and how they have their pictures set up. But I guess it's better than not seeing them side by side. And it's all, you know, the eye. I would assume, since the prices of OLED have not come down over the years, let's say over the last 5 years, that there really is something to the more expensive OLEDs, or else the OLED prices would be moving, you know, towards the LED prices or LCD prices, but they're not. They're staying more expensive. So, and the 8K, I'm just, with 8K and 4K, it's just about future-proofing the thing. You know, you don't want to buy a 4K and in three or four years have so much 8K streaming content that you wish you bought an 8K 4 years ago. That's the only choice. But if you go for an OLED that's 8K, you're talking about big bucks now. You're talking about, I don't know, $1,200, something like that, in that area, Roy. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, let me just go down the list because you mentioned a few things. Yeah, there's something called demo mode in which it's designed purely to put on display in stores, where they punch up the gamma of things that give your eyeballs an ache. And that's true. If you want to cheat people, you can make adjustments to the settings of these displays and have the stuff that's more profitable for your company to be selling better than better models that have less of a profit margin. And talking about profit margin, the profit margin, I believe, on organic light-emitting diodes is relatively low. Most manufacturers make more money selling the cheaper LCD high-end screens than the organic light-emitting diodes, and the production limitations don't look like they're going to go anywhere any day soon. Most of the guys who talk about all this believe that the future, the ultimate future, is something called micro-LEDs, in which the organic light-emitting diodes are replaced by inorganic LEDs. But until that happens, they feel that most of the companies are going to gravitate to small LEDs as backlighting that will, again, as I mentioned earlier, the darkness, the lack of darkness is because there's a backlight behind the black screen and it's bleeding through. So if you can address more and more backlit LEDs, you can limit the area of that gray instead of black. And it approaches that of organic light-emitting diodes. And for that, it looks like the price point will be lower. So you'll be able to sell at a lower price, make more profit. So before we get to micro-LEDs, that's probably going to be where most of the manufacturing gravitates to. Let me drop for a sec. Another point that you bring out is you want to future-proof your monitor, and I understand that. The only problem is that, as far as I can see, the majority of our software is going to be streamed. Very few people still have, you know, 4K Blu-ray discs that they buy. They have streaming services. And maybe the high-end streaming services will start to produce some more material in 8K, but those are compressed 8Ks. So they're not really truly 8Ks anyway. So, again, I don't know. It depends on how good your vision is and how close you want to sit to your monitor.
And how thin you want your wallet to be. Yeah, it's a tough choice now. It's a tough choice. Are there any shortages now? Do you know manufacturing shortages now with TVs, whether it's OLED or LED?
Well, to my knowledge, no. There's a lot of people who would like to. They saw what Consumer Electronics Show has in store for 2024, and they think they could cut a better deal by buying a 2023 monitor. Some of the real high-end, good price points have already been sold away, so there's nothing in stock. But the manufacturing of screens and such, they're pumping them out like nobody's business. So offhand, I'm unaware of any particular production limitations anymore. You know, we're past the integrated circuit shortages, and there's never really been a big shortage in display screen technology. These companies pump them out 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You know, the engineers back in the 70s, if they were to see back then what a 55-inch, $350 flat screen looks like now, they wouldn't believe it. They wouldn't believe it, because even though I still have blotchy blacks, you know, real black areas, if there's a wide area of black, it blotches a little bit. But other than that, I'm always amazed. I keep saying to myself, boy, if those guys could see this now. So I'll keep the TechNet up to date as I get further into this. I'm just starting on the quest for the best buy for, let's say, a 55, 60-inch panel. All right, Roy, thanks. W2BZ.
You're welcome. And please come back and tell us how it went. And like I said, as much as resolution and illumination and dynamic range are important, don't sell short of the ability to upscale. A sophisticated engine algorithm that can take a 720 or a 1080 and upscale it to 4K is a thing of beauty. Any other comments out there regarding televisions? We all own them. We all use them. We all love them. There's one or two guys out there who says, I don't watch television. Okay.
And to repeat here.
Yes.
I'll just... Am I still there?
You dropped out. You said your call sign, and you said, I'm just, and that was it.
Okay, I'm trying again here. I'm just wondering, you know, our vision gets a little worse as we get older. So to older people, how well does it work with these new TVs? Can you even appreciate the difference?
PhD.
Yes, Jim?
I think that's an excellent question. And as my vision deteriorates, I'm a young ham, it's under 60. And when I look at these things in the shop, you know, you go to Home Depot and you see the TVs, the OLEDs jump out of me. They jump out of me. I don't like to put on glasses to watch TV. And when it's so vivid and so, the contrast is so stark and so crisp, and the light is so powerful, I don't need to put on glasses with these TVs. And it's an amazing experience that's far exceeds what I've seen in the past. I think it's really cool. I think it's a great advancement from the entertainment value of it. I'd rather read than watch a movie myself, but when I do, it's nice to have that. I think it's tremendous as our vision degrades.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's up to the individual. There are some guys who are 80 years old and their vision is wonderful. There are other people who they're teenagers and they wear Coke bottles or they shift over to contact lenses or they have optical surgery to correct their vision problems. Yeah, but the same thing kind of goes with sound equipment. There are guys who supposedly have perfect pitch and keen hearing. I know that I no longer can hear a damn thing beyond 10,000 hertz. But you could buy headphones that go up to 24,000. I'm sure, you know, that's great for 16 and 18 year olds. But it's kind of wasted on most people our age. But, you know, it depends on, you know, you might have found the fountain of youth. It, you know, some of it is unfortunately bragging rights. But others, you know, if you like to sit 3 inches away from your screen and be surrounded by it, and you have good near vision at least, then I guess 8K is something to look forward to. I would go blind trying to do that. I mean, my vision, unfortunately, at this point is so mediocre that I don't even bother getting videos that are higher resolution than 720. You know, it's a waste of my time to get some 2K AVI. Version of a movie file. But, you know, caveat emptor and then, you know, whatever suits a person. If you got perfect eyes or perfect ears and you have the money to spend, then, you know, so be it.
VHD would have thought on the 8K.
Sure, Jim.
Seems to me that those standards that are so, the pixels are so small, it's really all about supporting very large screens, either now or in the future. That seems to me to be the direction of what that technology goes to. It's not so much about making the picture better on our normal size screens, which are now, what, 55, 60? But 8 feet screens would benefit from those higher resolutions. Just my take. Back to Roy.
AC2GS. Well, yeah, but I mean, also it's kind of a function between your distance from the screen and the size of the screen. If you if you stay at the same distance as you make the screen bigger, then you make the pixels more obvious. But you know, if the pixels are more obvious to you, you could just move your seat 1 foot, and that problem should go away. They are really promoting, again, because of the profit margin is higher with the larger screens. They're promoting a lot of large screen technology, especially at the Consumer Electronics Show. There were a lot of 100-plus inch diagonal monitors out there, and the manufacturer would like to sell a lot of them to us. You know, it becomes, you know, I mean, how big a TV set can you put in a bedroom? About 20 years ago, if you asked me that, I would say 42-inch. I think now people regularly put 65-inch diagonal flat screens in their bedroom, and probably guys with more money put in the 100-plus inch diagonal. So, you know.
I have an interesting twist on this conversation.
Sure.
I myself don't have lots of rooms, don't have lots of money, and lots of people do, and they'll have a giant screen home theater in the basement. I don't know, lots of people, but some people have that. But what I've enjoyed much about these high-quality displays on a flat screen is I can put it in my living room, and it doesn't take over the living room. I can shut it off, push it back against the wall, and the living room becomes a human place rather than just a place to watch some content from somewhere else. It's much easier to do that nowadays with the equipment available than it used to be, where a projection TV or a big tube TV, they took up command of the room like a fireplace did. But a flat screen can just push back and be off, and as long as you don't get your knucklehead uncle that turns on a football game while you got 37 people gathered for Christmas and he wants to eat the whole room for a football game, I find it to be a great move forward to making the TV be an accessory rather than the focal point of a room. So I've been enjoying where the TV technology has been going myself.
Well, yeah, I mean, flat screen was very popular in science fiction when they were able to fake it, and some people actually spent the money on a projector that kind of faked a flat screen. Nowadays, you could mount it on a wall like a painting or another picture, and there are a bunch of manufacturers that have frame TVs, they call them. They have a frame around them like it's a picture. And it's barely less than an inch in thickness, and there's usually a control box hidden someplace else. The size of televisions were very weird when they first came out, because the electronics took up so much space. You had the vacuum tubes and a whole bunch of other things going on. When I was a little kid, we had an old black and white. The monitor had to be maybe about 12 inches diagonal, but it took up the better part of it looked like a chest of drawers. Those went down because the electronics was shrinkable, but you still had to deal with the cathode ray tube. And so my last cathode ray tube was a ridiculous 42-inch, I think, diagonal. It weighed something like 300 pounds and took up a lot of space. So, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, it's a godsend, these flat screens, and they're getting flatter with every iteration and every year. Mine is a rather old flat screen LCD. But it's about maybe 2 inches thick, which is very thick in today's modern flat-screen TV technology.
It's funny. I still remember watching the Apollo missions of, I guess I was about 5 years old, on a Magnavox in a wood cabinet with a big pulled on-off button that went ka-clunk, ka-clunk when you turned it on and off, black and white. And it was pretty big for the time. I forget the size it was. It was a pretty big screen, black and white. But I remember that. Crazy, right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, what we've gone through, and Rich mentioned, what if you kind of took some old engineers from the 50s into the future, and they would be amazed. You know, and every so often I kind of daydream that would I really have wanted to know what the future had in store? And, you know, my feelings, at least this week, is that probably not. I would be disappointed that I would have to wait 50, 60 years to enjoy them. You know, I guess I prefer it this way if I had a choice one way or the other.
WB2EAV.
Yes, Ed.
Two items. Item number one. I still remember. It was about my bar mitzvah. It was around Christmas time, 1959. My dad had delivered a brand new General Electric 21-inch black and white television that replaced our old RCA that was like you described. And I was just blown away by the new technology. And to tell you the truth, to this day, I'm still pretty much staying with the same television. Though I must admit, I did eventually go over the color, but long after everybody else did. And even today, it still is my house. We still have a pair of 32-inch, but that's diagonal, so it's really like 28 by the old measurement system. So I've been pretty consistent with that. And if you talk about old engineers from the 50s, I guess I qualified because I was already pretty much interested in it before the 50s ended. Although, you know, I was a kid, but I was interested in such things. And yeah, I've watched it develop. And I have to tell you, there have been some amazing changes. But I really don't think television really counts as much as smartphones, where you not only have personal communication within reason wherever you are, but a full navigation system. And that's the one that really boggles my mind, far more so than television. And just some thoughts. WB2AV.
AC2GS. I appreciate that, Ed. And you know, I don't think that television technology should win a particular award for having made the biggest changes. It's one of 3 billion different type of technologies that have made enormous strides in the last 50, 60 years. I mean, unfortunately, one of the industries that haven't made technological strides that much has been a rocket propulsion. They pretty much kind of use the same system. They may finesse it with some slightly more new materials and stuff, but it hasn't really changed that much since the 60s. You know, there are other things. Battery technology kind of hiccuped a little bit with lithium technology, but otherwise it's kind of been slow. Solid state has been ridiculously expansive. I mentioned earlier on my 10-meter net today that in the 1980s, I remember being in a computer store where they were trying to sell a hard drive with a capacity of 2 megabytes for $2,000. You can't even buy anything that stores 2 megabytes. No one will manufacture something with that small a capacity. So there's a lot, and Stu earlier tonight mentioned about medicine certainly has made enormous strides forward. So, you know, they're all going forward. Some are going faster than others, though.
Some more thoughts?
excitingly.
About stuff with the technology.
N2BHD mobiles.
Now, this is a little bit of cheating, but the technology has changed tremendously. But if a 1959 vintage Boeing 707 rolls up at the gate at Kennedy Airport, I bet 90% of the passengers wouldn't even notice the difference from, you know, the plane you expect today. I mean, some would be absolutely mind-boggled, you know, saying, my God, what are they doing? This is a museum piece. Some would say, I don't know, some ain't quite right, but here I put my finger on it. I think the most of them wouldn't even notice the difference. And think about it, it hasn't really changed from the passenger standpoint in all these years. And let's see. Well, I don't remember. Let me drop back to it.
Well, I think with aeronautics, the advances are kind of hidden inside. You know, if you had someone running around the inside of the plane's guts, they would probably, if they knew enough, would notice the enormous differences and how things don't work like they used to. Hopefully for the better. By the way, I heard Ken from South Dakota had a little bit of a snippet. So I just want to say hello back to Ken. I spoke with Ken this morning on the Kings County Radio Club's 10-meter net that I do net control for. So I just want to say hello to Ken. Let's get a hello back. Oh, well, I guess not. He seems to have fallen off of Echo Link. He may reconnect on. You know, sometimes he's at a intermittent type of a connection. So, you know, I agree with you. I mean, there's a lot of technology that's advanced, but not in very obvious ways. You know, jet planes kind of work like jet planes did back in 1950 and 60. The control systems probably are completely different, but you don't see that from the outside. And for the most part, you don't see that from the passenger areas. You might notice that there are a few more strange connectors that are offered you. You know, like I wonder what a person from 1960 would take from something labeled as USB.
I do have some comments here.
Certainly.
I think you would notice those who are paying attention but not really up to date with technology would probably first notice as the plane pulls up to the gate, if it was a 1959 vintage 707, the engine would be much bigger, because this was before they developed the high bypass turbofan, which is the standard today. And also, you might comment about medical science. I have done something that's completely off the wall heresy. There's a lot of stuff in the fiction about zombies and all that. And I say the following. The zombie apocalypse is real, and it's here, and I'll bet half the people listening today, by my definition, are zombies. Anybody who has heart surgery, anybody who has recovered from cancer. 15 years ago, we were all dead. And that's my definition of a zombie.
Okay. Thankfully, you know, once they get cured or treated or bypass surgery, they don't have an appetite for brains, at least.
Well, I think that whole thing is ridiculous. I never understood why the zombies would have an appetite for brains, even if they took it at face value.
Well, the problem is that they have to be an adversarial agent, and so they have to need something from people. They have to have some motivation to threaten people. If they just kind of wandered aimlessly, you know, they'd be inconveniences. Unfortunately, people would equate them about the same as homeless people. So if you add that little addition of them surviving on for some reason the brains of living human beings, it gives a perfect adversarial type of situation. As it is, the way that they usually construct zombies, they shuffle around. It's, you know, unless you're paralyzed, it's very easy to walk out of the way of a dozen zombies out to eat your brains.
Is this anything like the way UFO occupants are obsessed with the human lower digestive tract? Couldn't care less about this.